Katie's energy is infectious and her authenticity is refreshing. And you can tell how much we match each other's energy just by how hyper we are and seriously how fast we get talking. If it sometimes seems like we're on like 1.5 speed or 2.0 speed rather than the regular 1.0, we're not. We just talk like maniacs sometimes, but we discuss her journey becoming transgender, her struggles with mental health, and we actually really dive into a time where she attempted suicide. So if this is a trigger for you, this is a warning, but also give a little bit of a listen and see how you feel, because Katie really just discusses her life in the most open, honest, and genuine and beautiful way. So thank you, Katie, for being on here. And thank you to our sponsor, Pick My Brain, because you need to follow up with Katie after this. If you listen to everything she has to say and really jam about it and want to know more about what it's like to be transgender or struggling with mental illness or bipolar disorder and, you know, getting into a dark place and anything, love, life, excitement, openness, Katie is there for. And so you can find Katie John Wendt on pickmybrain.world if you go to brains, and you can just search up her name and you can book her for a call and you won't regret it. I definitely left this call, one, needing a huge glass of water, even though I drink it throughout, but also just feeling really inspired and like there are such genuine open people in this world. So thank you, Katie, and make sure you go book her on Pick My Brain. Thank you to Pick My Brain. There are so many amazing people we call brains on this platform that you can dive into. And if you are looking to expand your mind, learn more, or just connect with someone in a cool way, go to pickmybrain.world. And enjoy the episode. Make sure you also check Katie out on Instagram and follow me on Instagram at humantohumanpod, at Jessica J. McDonald. You can watch this on YouTube if you want, and you can also check out my personal YouTube channel, which I never shout out here. So it's also in the link of the show notes. It's in the link of everything and, you know, the bio of the Instagram, all of that. So check that out. And anyway, without further ado, here's Katie and my conversation. Well, I'm going to welcome you to Human. I'm so excited to have you here. I feel like it's like a long time coming, season two, finally getting you on.
Oh, I'm season two. That's great. I like that.
Yeah, season two. Yeah. So do you want to introduce yourself? I'm so excited to have you, Katie. We met through the incredible Pick My Brain platform and Maxine. And I'd love if you want to give a bit of an introduction of yourself and what you're up to.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, I'm Katie, or Katie John. I really don't mind. You know, pronouns wise, I go by they, she, or he if I'm not really feeling bothered that day. but who I am is all about basically finding me, and everything that I do and am doing now is all about finally finding the jobs and projects that I love. So I'm, you know, a speaker and educator on everything from gender and mental health to sexuality, human rights, and particularly about authenticity, diversity, inclusion, belonging. But I'm madly keen on books, art, culture, politics, economics, the lot. So I was really, you know, really lucky to get involved with both Pick My Brain and also the Human Library and an art project that I work for. And I love everything I do. I love that I can finally be in passion jobs, having previously run a tech company for 15 years, which was like too much pressure and like too nerdy. And I'm much happier now doing passion projects. So that's kind of where I am. But I love writing. I love reading. I have 6,000 books. Love cats, music, play lots of instruments, speak lots of languages, and photography, really, and cookery. They're my things that calm me, because I get still behind a lens or still behind a frying pan, and it slows me right down. You'll pick up that occasionally within this, I can speak passionately and animatedly at very fast speeds, which is fine because you do too.
Yes.
It must be a family trait between you and Max and a few others.
It really is. And my favorite people are the people that just match that energy. And you totally do. And I love that so much. And I love that you mentioned too, kind of getting behind a lens and in front of a frying pan and having those things that help you slow down. Cause boy, do I need those too.
Yeah. But it's interesting though, because a lot of other people, so, you know, I'm polyamorous, I'm asexual, but the person I've been with the longest over the last 8 years is one of your previous guests, Esther, who is fabulous and gorgeous and lovely. Esther and I have opposite personality types. She moved in with me for 2 years and then moved out again. She probably would have moved out quicker if she could. because she's an introvert and I'm mostly an extrovert, although COVID has fucking changed me, so that's a whole new story. And I've got used to being on my own and loving it. Esther's realized that she likes to be on her own too. Solo Polly. It's not that there's a wrong way of being. It's just that some people need a different way of being around you, and for them to be themselves they need to back off a bit and get some space from your high energy. But there are some people with high energy love others with high energy, because then no one is out there judging you or criticizing you for talking too fast or coming up with another idea or going off on a tangent or interrupting is a sign of interest.
Yes,
highly passionate, highly functional, highly multiple potential people, because you said something. I want to go over there. And that's a sign of interest. The fact that I'm cutting you off mid-sentence is because you've sent me down a rabbit hole, is me being fascinated with the last thing you said. And I don't want to wait for you to finish it. I want to go here. I want to go there. And because we're so kind of multi-tracking, we can all go back if we need to.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. My brain is like, oh my god, I have had to learn not to interrupt people though, because on the podcast I want it all, but then I'll have moments where I'm like, I need to write that down because I need to bring it up later, like, oh my gosh. And I love that you said that too, because I feel like when you talk to people, you just know what the energy level is, like if you're matching it, if you're people who jive. I love the energy, I love the excitement, I love the passion. You know that we match about that in so many ways, and I just love how much of an open book you are. I feel like you are like, I am down to talk about everything, like all. And I think too, through what you're saying, what I took away from it too, is it's just so important to follow your passions and follow the things that you love and find, you know, what your root is. And it doesn't look linear. I feel like your life, I'm sure, has been just so changing in such fast direction.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with trying everything, including boyfriends or girlfriends or both, or more than one at once, in order to find what you want and who you are. So I tried loads of jobs. I've tried loads of genders. I've tried loads of sexualities. I've been every letter of LGBTIQAP and all the rest. You know, and I used to read autobiographies of people and go, oh, this is me. Flip a page. Oh my God, that chapter's not me. Right, put it down. And I used to search out other people's stories to find me, and always eventually find a point where their story went in a different direction. And I go, oh no, that's not me. And I remember going to like transgender support groups and going, oh, they're nothing like me. I thought there was only one way to be trans. I didn't realize I could be me. And discovering that with everything from jobs to sexuality to personality to where you live, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I don't want kids. I could never have them anyway. I was infertile. And I was lucky to be with someone, Esther, who didn't want them. But it's there are so many ways of being, and no one should judge you for being any of them. And there's no harm in trying different hats on for size and then realizing it doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. 100%. And I feel like it takes a while to learn that too. I think like so much of the time, especially like being quite young myself, there's just so many different expectations.
Me being quite old. What are you saying? No, carry
on. I'm not saying you're old. I'm just saying it takes a while in life. But it's just so, I feel so lucky to be able to sit and have these conversations and communicate with people who are, you know, quite a big age difference from me, to learn I can be exactly who I am. And oftentimes I come out of my room finishing podcast episodes and my dad is like, who were you talking to? Like, my God, all I hear is because that's what it is. And that's what gets me excited. And that's when you know I'm like living a life I love.
Time is the one thing you can never get back, but age to me is a construct. It's how you treat it, it's what you do with it. I turned 54 in an 8 weeks time, and I don't fucking care. I've never been happier than in my 50s, but I don't see myself as in my 50s. I see myself as in my noughties, because I lost 15 years when I got divorced. I went from 39 to 24 overnight, and suddenly thought, oh, I can live again, let's see what happens. And then I rebooted my life, and you know, and I didn't start wearing Dr. Martens and behaving like a rebellious twit until I was in my early 40s. But there is a certain point sometimes, and it often is your 40s or later, with either things like divorce or transition or coming out, that you finally think, I don't give a fuck what people think. Well, actually, I do. It's totally wrong for people to say that, because it's true. Everybody does give a fuck about what everyone thinks. You know, let's be genuine about this. We care, and that's why we get hurt, and that's why we care about appearance. You know, I wasn't going to come on this podcast till I got dressed. You know, even though it's audio, but it makes a difference in my head.
Me too.
But the you know, but the point is, we to be able to be ourselves and not care as much, and in fact to care mostly about what we think about ourselves rather than what others think about ourselves, is an incredible freedom to arrive at. And people who, you know, who are teens and 20s are always asking me, how do I get there, Katie? How do I get there? I say, well, I'd love to give you the magic bullet, which is really easy. Just get on with life and be yourself. And it's as simple as that. But the only way you're going to get there is by turning the chapters to your own life, making your own mistakes and owning them. It's like the whole, that's why I don't like really self-help gurus. And, you know, and I read so many books about finding yourself and self-help stuff. And I went on self-help workshops off to California and everywhere else like this, and followed loads of things thinking I was looking for the answer. And of course the answer is within. And a true self-help guru, like a decent therapist, just helps you to help yourself rather than helps you follow them. Any self-help guru that puts themselves on a pedestal, or you inadvertently put them on a pedestal, which often happens as much.
Yeah.
And they're basically saying, hey, I've got to the top of the mountain. This is my 6-step plan to get to my mountain. And it's $497 to get there, you know.
Yeah.
But if you come on my workshops, join my program, become a fan girl boy person, you will get to my nadir, my mountaintop, my nirvana. And you can be me. But you don't want to be me, you know. I want to be me, not them me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%.
That means learning a few tools and lessons from them and then abandoning them and going to find your own mountain and climbing it your own way. And if that means going round the kind of the goat track really, really slowly, spirally until you get to the top, or rushing up like a mountain climber or whatever it might be, you know, or cheating and dropping off from a helicopter and landing there. The whole point is you've got to find your own way. And unless you find your own way, you'll never stand on the foundations of your own journey. So that's why you can't shortcut to be yourself, but you can get there really quickly. It's just that you're the only one who can determine that speed.
Yeah, I feel like I need to clap at the end of that. Like, that was just, that was like, I don't even know if I can add. 100%. Oh my gosh. And just like, I think that's what's so important is that I started to realize, I'm like, these self-help people stress me the fuck out. Like, oh my God. Like, because you see all these things that they're saying you need to do, but it's so important to just take what works for you and run with it. And that's sometimes I'll sit here and be like questioning the podcast and questioning what I'm doing with it. But I'm like, I am not here to tell people how to live their life. I am here talking about what I've experienced, what's helped me. I'm bringing people on to talk about their lives. And when people like say, like, if my friends are like, oh my God, I'm sorry, I have not listened, I'm like, oh my God, first of all, don't be sorry. I never expect people to listen. And if someone's like, oh, what episode should I listen to? I'm like, just scroll whatever title you think you'd resonate with, listen to it. Don't listen to something you don't think you care about or fuck with. Like, why would you do that? Listen to the thing that calls to you, and hopefully it helps you find yourself more in your own journey.
Oh, totally. Which is why I don't like, as I said, these programmatic approaches. These are the four laws. These are the 6 steps. These are the 9 points. Because it doesn't matter. I bought the book Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. I've never read it, but I bought the book, read the front cover, and said, okay, fine, I'm doing that. And I, you know, I found there were some risks to that, because there's some things where you shouldn't feel the fear and do it anyway. Like, I'm afraid of jumping in front of a bus. I'm going to jump in front of a bus. No, don't do that. That's stupid. So, but the, you know, and I'm bipolar, so I have a whole switch in my head that occasionally goes, I love fearful things, because when I get high, I lose all my fear because of the chemicals rushing around my brain, because of the, you know, the mental spectrum condition that gives me a kind of an unnatural fearlessness at that point. And I actually seek out risky things and I love it. So occasionally Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway is kind of the last thing I want to do. But Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway was one of the books I didn't read, but read the cover when I decided to kind of come out and embrace myself. So sometimes you just need to read the cover and then write the inside of the book yourself. That's that song. There's that Natasha Bedingfield song, isn't it? Only you can feel the raindrops on your head, and only you can write your page. Your
That's so good. It's so good. And I read somewhere recently too, like, if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough. And I'm like, oh, I like that. Like, I think it's so important for us to push ourselves to, you know, think bigger. But I even want to dive into experiencing having a bipolar disorder and how you navigate that, and when you kind of discover that you had this thing that you have to live with.
Well, I was married to a psychiatrist 15 years, and she told my psychiatrist that I didn't have bipolar, which was a breach of confidentiality for starters. But I changed my psychiatrist after that, made a complaint, and I became patient A in the system so that my notes couldn't be seen by my ex-wife, who was in the same system still.
Wow. But,
anyone else who's bipolar who's met me goes, you're bipolar. Wow. So it takes one to know one is the best diagnosis. And in the end, yeah, I got two or three. Bipolar is really interesting, actually, because, I mean, it's a mood disorder. Mood disorders are a spectrum. Whether you handle your moods and your energies, it makes you kind of euthymic and, I hate the word normal, but able to cope in life with everything. But if your moods affect you severely enough to impact your life, to impact your relationships, to impact your work, your business, your family, etc., then it can be seen as damaging. And if the impact is of the moods is sufficient to consistently affect you that way, then you're pretty much on a mood disorder spectrum. I love the fact that, you know, that the mood affective disorder spectrum is the initials, the acronym MAD, M-A-D. So I am legitimately mad. I also collect acronyms and OCD shit like that, but I'm mad, bad, gad and sad. So I have a mood affective disorder. I have bipolar affective disorder. I have a generalized anxiety disorder and seasonal affective disorder. And I'll collect anything else that ends in AD for the fun of it. No, but they're the four I've been diagnosed with by a legitimate psychiatrist after 2 hours. So what, you know, at the end of the day, what do they know? Whereas bipolar people who lived it 24/7 say, Katie, have you ever considered a bipolar diagnosis? And it actually took bipolar people to really wake me up to it. And then it started making so much fucking sense. People who are also ENFP are the most likely to be bipolar. People who are trans are disproportionately bipolar as well. You know, wow. So there's lots of little comorbidities and personality aspects to it. But it was someone who I met actually through the Human Library, who was a bipolar person in the Human Library, who had part of the Human Library, which is something I work for as well, is about people being able to tell their story, to give you the opportunity to ask them questions about anything, which is why I say no holds barred. You can ask me anything. I take no offense. Mm-hmm. You know, the very things you kind of think you can, I shouldn't ask them about their suicide, or I shouldn't ask them about their surgery. Well, when I go up as a Human Library book, I say, yeah, you can ask many of those things. Even the things you wouldn't normally ask a trans person or a bipolar person, you can in the Human Library for that 30-minute zone. And so I was asking this person about the fact that they had lots of cuts on their arm. And I said, do you mind if I ask you a question, you know, about the marks on your arm, obviously looking like self-harm or a suicide attempt? And I asked them, I said, you know, did you do them when you were high rather than low? And I said, oh, my God, no one has ever asked me that. They've always assumed I was depressed when I tried to cut myself. No one has ever had the insight to ask me, you did that when you were manic, when you were high. And I said, so tell me more. And they said, yeah, they tried to cut their arm off with a bread knife because they thought it would grow back because they were in a manic state. Wow. And they thought they had regenerative capacity. You know, it was just the out of the blue thought that I had in engagement. And then at the end of this whole conversation, they just said, look, Katie, you know, you probably need to consider that you might be bipolar too for some of the things you've said and the way you've engaged with me. And this is what I use to manage my life. And it was something called the Bipolar Mood Diary. And there's two reasons I came off medication 8 years ago. I mean, bipolar is something that takes on average 10 and a half years to diagnose and typically 3 to 4 misdiagnoses en route. And I was pretty much textbook for that. Wow. Depression at 35 and suicide at 44. And between that, loads of things going wrong. And I eventually came off my meds by choice, cut them in half and then removed them completely. And I've been off meds for 8.5 years and way happier. But I won't recommend that to anyone because, again, that's your own. You've got to follow your own path and your own advice and make your own safety checks. But my medication became the things that I do that fulfill me, the things that I do that calm me. If I'm feeling low, I get another cat. You know, that's why I've got a lot, about 11 at the last count. So it's an indication of the bad periods in my life. No, but I stroke a cat, you know, and there are things that I will do to de-stress. Back to the bipolar mood diary. The bipolar mood diary I was introduced to is a scale from 0 to 10. 0 means you're dead. 10 means you're dead. 1 means you're suicidal and contemplating death. And 9 means you think you're Superman and you're about to jump off a tall building thinking you can fly. And if you do that, 10 will mean you're dead. So you can end up dead at either end of the scale. They're both extremes. So in other words, you can die from the result of manic behaviours at the top of the scale as much as depressive behaviours at the bottom of the scale. And, you know, most there's a if you imagine 4, 5, and 6 as the green territory in the middle, I use a traffic light system. So the middle is green. Then you go to amber either side and then to red at the extremes. And then the light goes off at 0 and 10. But 4, 5, and 6 are what most people experience day in, day out. It's just called living. It's fine. It's normal. A few ups, a few downs. You know, you get a 7 when someone proposes to you and, you know, and you're going to get engaged. Actually, to someone that you want to marry, hopefully. You know, if you don't, then you're not going to feel a 7. You go, oh shit, my stalker wants to marry me. No, but but 7 is your best happy day as a kind of a normal mood person, and 3 is your worst day because you just got fired. You know, but bipolar people don't really experience 4, 5s, and 6s at all. 3 and 7s, there are kind of our norm. And we sit in the 2s and 3s and the 7s and 8s. And I fucking love the 7s because it's like being constantly proposed to. I don't want to get married. It's fine. Done it once, no more. But the, you know, as an equivalent at 7, I'm hyper productive, hyper creative, hyper happy, hyper confident. I can get on stage and talk to 2000 people fearlessly. But if I'm a 3, and I had to do a TED talk when I was feeling like a 3. So at 3, I was having to go up on stage, shitting myself, panic attacking, anxiety. Everything that I ate that day went straight out the other end. It was, and they were giving out free sushi all day. It was horrible. I wanted to eat.
It's not a good combination. If it is, you're just feeling stressed and having panic attacks all day, and then everything's coming right out the other end. Sushi is the last thing you should be eating.
But the point, in the end, though, by being aware that I was a 3, I went on stage and I put 3 friends in the front row and I said, look, if you see me either going manic or getting really, really anxious, just please come up on stage and hold my hand or stroke my hair. If they come and stroke my hair, it's the equivalent of me stroking a cat. If someone comes up and strokes my hair, I become putty in their hands. I also calm, I slow, my breathing calms. And I've had that before, and I've actually done one thing where I was presenting at an event to a corporate client, and my partner was there, and they saw I was having a hard time, and they came up and literally just stood beside me and held my hand. And my friends know to hold my hand or stroke my hair if I'm either hyper anxious or hyper manic. And that immediately brings me back into the zone. And I learned some of this stuff actually before I was even diagnosed with it, when I was going out with this wonderful girl called Rainbow in America. I mean, who wouldn't go out with someone called Rainbow? But she was a therapist as well by trade, and also a shaman. So I was massively into rooting yourself, you know, in nature and cleansing yourself and all these kind of things, but also understood the mind and the body. She was a somatic therapist, so she was aware of what's going on in the body. And she taught me the word authentic, if anything else. And that's probably one of the best things I ever got out of my relationship with her. You know, this the challenge to be authentic, because she kept challenging me. She said, Katie, are you really being you?
And
do you know what you want, and does this really open you, or are you doing it because you're trying to please me? So you know, we had an energetic relationship, and I still love her to this day. Visited her about 2 years ago, even though we only went out about 11 years ago for a year. But she taught, one of the things she challenged me to do one day was to go outside in my bare feet and stand in wet dewy grass.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I was just talking about that the other day on a podcast episode. I just like, because my therapist gave me that advice as well. And she's like, ways to slow down. Mindfulness does not need to look one specific way. Go outside without your shoes on and just stand there. Like, it doesn't
need to. Because I hate mindfulness. Because my mind is so full. How am I going to get anything else mindful in it? And if you try and empty your mind,
it doesn't work
for hyper energy people. And if you try and do it, it will screw you up.
Exactly. Literally, yesterday.
You need distraction. And some of the distractions are either like binging a series on Netflix, or standing in the cold or wet, or anything physical that brings you and grounds you. So that's what my hair does, or standing in bare feet in the
That's why I love swimming. That's why I love being in water. Oh my God. That's why I love being around water, because I'll just stare at it. And like, even my mom and I were just talking yesterday. I was like, Mom, you don't get it. I like having things to worry. Like, I don't like it, but my brain likes it. Like, if there's nothing going on, it will find something to think about.
And it's in the end, it's counterproductive to try and switch that off.
Yeah.
Instead, it's better to write them down, go and do something, one of them, put them
find
in
the things
room
that work,
and say, guys, you know, I love all your thoughts. They're really constructive, but there's just a little few too many coming at once. Can you guys get a room and go and discuss your stuff in a side room? Because I'm going for a swim. And then I'll come back to you. And when you're calm, I'll take you in turn.
I love that so much. That's such a good way to put it. Oh my God.
I talk to myself. I talk to my head. I don't have multiple voices, but my thoughts have different voices. And that doesn't mean it's a mental health condition. It's a human health condition.
Oh my God, 100%. That is a human thing. Exactly. Yeah.
And so, by giving voice to them, everybody has at least two voices in their head. And they're not necessarily kind of pathologized for that. The two voices you have in your head are your good voice, your bad voice, you know, your Madonna versus prostitute, your angel versus demon voice. I want to do this or not? You know, and we do the to and fro, the binary voices. So what's wrong with the people who are blessed to have even more than a binary voice? Like the one voice that says, let's do it, be a little bit naughty and a little bit cautious. Because that's quite a good voice, actually. So let's, you know, why not?
100%. There's so many voices in our head. And someone said to me recently too, like sometimes you need to talk to yourself like you're a little kid and be like, okay, Jess, what we're going to do today is you're just going to spend a little bit less time on your phone. Like you get 20 minutes and then you're going to take a little break. And like, yeah, acknowledging them. Cause sometimes I'm like, oh my God, they're so annoying. I'm annoying myself. So I feel like doing that, being like, I love that. I'm going to put you in a room and you're just going to like stay there for a bit. Let me live my life. And we're going to come back. And like, I appreciate you, but I just like need a little break for a hot minute.
Talk to yourself in the mirror. Take the piss out of yourself is the most healthy thing you can do. And, you know, so I'll do something and I go, oh, you fucking idiot. What were you thinking? But then I mock myself and I laugh at myself. And it's so healthy. And I just think, and it just takes the edge off.
Absolutely.
So castigating myself, I mock myself gently.
I think it's because if we can't laugh at ourselves, like what can we do? And that's a part of getting to know ourselves better and doing things for ourselves because, you know, it's so easy to like hear other people's ideas and opinions on us and be like, you know what? No, what do I want? And like, why? I don't understand when people are like, oh, like I've had people say to me, like I've had partners say to me, like, you're so hyper. And my old roommate, like she's one of my best friends. She's like, Jess, that is my favorite quality about you. The fact that someone said that in a negative way, she's like, that is my favorite thing. You coming into the kitchen being like, I had a thought. Let me tell you about it. Like, don't let people knock you down for the things that make you like not as quote unquote normal or like we should never try.
If you're hyper and that's you, that's authentic. And why would people want you to not be yourself? Yeah, I mean, if you're in a group setting, you have to balance the energies in the room. But if you're just being you in your space, be you. And the people who are attracted to that or want to be around it can like take as much of you as they want or as little in that moment.
Exactly. 100%. Oh my gosh. So much goodness. Like, I just feel like after this, I'm going to need to just like sit and just like mull it over. It's so good. Oh my gosh. I just like love everything you have to say. Okay. I also want to talk about like where we went super down the tangent of like bipolar disorder and mental health. And I also really want to talk about suicide and kind of the mindset, the place you're in at that point in your life and where you've come from then and how you got through that time period.
I've actually been talking about it online today because there's a kind of a whole scary Facebook rant going on in a Facebook group about transgender people and suicide. Yes, I attempted suicide during my coming out journey, but it wasn't the only and it probably wasn't even the main reason why I attempted suicide on that day. The main reason I attempted suicide on that day was socioeconomic reasons. But yes, partly brought on by the curve of my life being trans, because when you're trans and you come out, you lose your marriage, your business starts to go down the trolley and I was thrown out of my church. So wow. I lost my faith community. I lost my marriage. I nearly lost my business. And I lost a lot of my friends.
I remember you saying as well that someone outed you, like you were a bit outed, like you didn't choose.
Oh, I was a lot outed.
Okay.
if I hadn't been outed by my ex, I would probably have taken another 10 years to come out. So in the end, it was a good thing. And I'm now really grateful to her because if she hadn't have called me on it, but the way she did it, I can forgive her anything and in that sense. So it's not a problem. But the way she did it, I didn't like. And to the point where, you know, ringing up my parents and say, do you know your son is this? And then ringing up members of the church and telling her medical colleagues and telling our friends. And our
wow.
And and I lost, and it, but it really tests. It's quite a good, useful thing to do. You should always have. That's why I swear I will never have any skeletons now in my closet. That they're all hanging on the front door of my closet now, visible to everyone. And I have no secrets, and that's why I am who I am wherever I am. You know, and because that means no one's got anything to blackmail me over, because I've been blackmailed before, effectively. So the whole process of being, of coming out, was a whole blackmail experience and a threat. And I had threats, threats of violence, threats of outing, threats of this, threats of divorce. In the end, I went for the divorce one, and so left with two evils. But the, but, you know, when she rang up my parents and said, "Your son is this," and my parents then rang me back and said, "Is this true?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess, but, you know, I'm shocked that she told you like that." And they said, "So are we. You know, we're going to rally round. We don't understand, but we love you." And that was the first significant point at which I knew that their love transcended any information, because they were the best parents in the world. And you know, them getting used to things was a whole different curve, a whole different ball game. My mum is my best ally, advocate and friend still. And my dad died a few months ago, still calling me Jonathan, still calling me he, still not accepting that I was trans. But I knew 110% that he loved me, and I didn't see... an issue between those two things. And I eventually realized that it was more important to be known, loved and cared for by him than to have, you know, name and pronouns accepted. Now, for many other trans people, that wouldn't cut the mustard at all. But for me, it was the realization that relationship was more important than nomenclature. So, and that's where I got to with him. You know, and to this day, we don't know. There's a whole bunch of things about him we don't even know as to whether what the reasons were why he couldn't, you know, accept me linguistically, amongst other things. But in the end, he realized that I hadn't changed as a person on the inside, and he could carry on having discussions about economics, politics and business and art and theatre and culture and music. And the fact that the person in front of him had long hair and breasts was neither here nor there. So eventually he got past the physical, which is actually all you want anyone to do anyway, because trans people have the luxury of being able to change themselves, and other people don't in some respects. At the end of the day, you want to be with people, family and partners and friends, who see past your cover and actually know the person within. And so he realized the person within was still me. And then I knew he accepted that. And that became more important than him accepting the outer me. And so I've learned that in that respect. But the outing process, it was like being thrown in the swimming pool when you can't swim. At the deep end. And I had to make a choice, sink or swim at that point, or scream, someone get me out of here and put me back in the changing rooms. But I know I stayed and swam at that point, and realized that at the time I literally didn't have the balls, although I did have balls then. I literally didn't have the balls to come out. And actually, for someone to literally castrate me publicly was probably the best thing that could have happened to me. So she just put me out there mercilessly. And I thought, okay, where are we going to go with this? Now I'm out. And first thing I did is I went to a therapist and said, "Can you stop me being trans?" I eventually went to a psychiatrist and said, "Can you stop me being trans?" I went on a journey to try and stop being trans. And it didn't work.
No shit.
Oh, no, even when I was in my mid-20s, I had deliverance ministry from charismatic Christians to try and stop me being trans. I kind of confessed some things to them, and they tried to cast out transgender demons from me, and that didn't work either.
This comes back to, you can't run from who you are.
Exactly. So eventually, though, the way I got to who I am was through a bunch of accidents, which is why I say you can't predict your journey to arriving at you. It's like stepping out of your house in the morning and going on a journey around the whole fucking world, going to work, going to this, going to that. And then eventually you come home. Oh, shit. I was here all the time. You know, and the fact that some people is, or being on a train journey, and sometimes you get off on what's called a branch line track or a dead end track, and you get shunted off here and shut off there, or you stop at a station, get out and go for a wander and get on the train the next day. So sometimes you sit at various stations of your life and spend time there and explore it. And other times you get derailed, but it doesn't matter. Eventually you arrive. But the trick is to enjoy the journey. And I know that who I am today, and I love me now, who I am today and I accept me, is the sum total of everything I've ever been and everywhere I've been and everyone I've been with, and everything I've done. So if I was to go back, God, you know, heading up to 54, if I could have transitioned at 14, I would do now in hindsight. But at 14, I wouldn't. And
if you wouldn't, your life would 40, be so...
Yeah, your life I would be so different. Me now, if I had transitioned at 14, I'd be something and someone completely different. And I have accepted every part of my journey and integrated it. And I actually like it, but I wouldn't choose to undergo it again. But having embraced it and accepted it, I've let it teach me. So the whole being outed, it's rather weird, but I thank her for it, you know, because I really think she actually saved me 10 years. And I got to do it before I would have done. Although, again, I would have done it earlier. But so I have no ill feeling about that at all. There is no point holding ill feeling about anyone, because the only thing it does is harm yourself.
Absolutely. And that even makes me think, like, about that's 100% true about your past and then true about your future. Like, there's no reason to worry about what's coming up or what could happen or things that could go wrong, because no matter what you can do about it. There's nothing you can do about it. And your future self is going to deal with it. Your future self is going to navigate it, and it's going to make you into who you are. And that's why, like, I feel like too, people, when you get your heart broken or when you have a really tragic experience or you lose someone, you can be like, okay, I don't want to open myself up to that again. But I'm like, oh my God, I want to fall in love again. I want to just become so, like, happy or so close to someone, even though you can lose them. Because also, like, losing someone or something makes you find yourself more than ever.
Yeah. And I've learned to, as a result of that, to live in the moment. And I actually ended up going out with someone because I literally got on a plane on a trip. And I said, and I watched the movie on the plane was the Yes movie, the one about the guy who says yes to everything.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the film, but I thought, okay, I'm going to try that. And then I ended up in America for 2 weeks. I thought, I'm just going to say yes to everything and just not have any fear. And like, all kinds of doors opened everywhere. And I thought, okay, this is radical. And then I read another book that I didn't really read, but I read the front cover of, which was The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle.
You're like, not a book I did read, just the cover, but I learned stuff.
I get it. The Power of Now. Okay, do that shit. Okay. And I learned to live in the now, or what I've learned because of suicide, I've learned to call it the power of now plus one, which is, again, don't feel the fear and do it anyway. If what you want to do to yourself is to kill yourself. So my now power of now plus one is to always think, well, I still want to do this in the morning. Okay, let's give it a day. So I had this kind of overnight addition to the methodology of living in the now. If I still want to do it tomorrow, I'll do it. And that gets me through the night now, because I still feel suicidal once or twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
I've, you know, and I was only saved from my major suicide attempt 8.5 years ago by the accident and the luck of Facebook. I kind of wrote I thought it was a very cleverly worded goodbye message that wouldn't be interpreted as a goodbye message to someone. And they read it. And about 1:30 in the morning, I wasn't expecting to read it either at that time. I thought they'd get it in the morning after I'd done it. And they got this message, and they jumped on the phone to my next door neighbor and tried to get my next door neighbor up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go around and check on me. My next door neighbor was married to a policeman, and she always turned her phone off at night so it wouldn't disturb him because of his shift patterns. That night she'd forgotten to turn her phone off, left it on the kitchen table. So she's lying in bed and she hears her phone going off, and she thinks, shit, I've got to go down and turn that phone off or it's going to wake my husband. Goes downstairs and sees these texts. She panics, rushes around, and she'd known me, and this was like 8 years ago, so we were both in our mid-40s. She'd known me since I was 21. She used to live in London, and she moved 110 miles to live next door but one to me when a house became available, because we've been friends all that long. And we got on brilliantly and naughtily together. And so she rushes around at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and because she knows I don't lock my back door very often, or even if I did, she knows where the key was. She came straight in and saw all over my kitchen floor strewn medication boxes, pill pots, and she rushed upstairs starting to yell my name. And she found me in my bedroom, having already taken a bunch of pills, half a bottle of sort of vodka gone, and a couple of bottles of wine lined up, and about another 30 pills lined up in a nice neat little order, because I'd taken a pause on my suicide because of my OCD, is thinking, well, if I'm gonna be dead in the morning, I don't want to be found in a mess. So I decided to change my sheets.
Shut up. You changed your sheets.
I tried to tidy my bed for a 15-minute pause, and I thought, okay, I've taken a hefty number of sleeping tablets and paracetamol so far. I'm either going to fall asleep now, or if I don't, I'm going to continue to part two of the suicide. but I am going to tidy up first. And it's like that thing, something my mother had said, always change, her mother had told her before that, always wear fresh knickers to school in case you get run over by a bus, because you don't want to be found with dirty knickers in an accident or whatever. I thought, okay, I've got to be found in nice tidy clothes, teddy bedroom, you know. So I'm literally changing my underwear and changing my sheets and then about to embark on round two of the suicide. By the way, through all of this, this is kind of like manic OCD territory, but at the same time, I was also deadly calm and also have been crying for like 2 hours solid because I knew I was going to do it. I was sad to be exiting life, but I could think of no other solutions. And I was also being evicted the next morning. So losing my house the next morning was going to be the big pressure and all the rest. And so everything came at once. It's the straw that breaks the camel's back type thing. And I had a whole bunch of straws that broke in that moment. So I couldn't think of a single solution to get out of there. And so I planned it. And the message to a friend wasn't a suicide letter. It wasn't a cry for help. It was just me being courteous and saying goodbye sort of thing. But subtly, I was trying to, you know, I thought, you know, take a few hours to, when even when she read it, it would take hours to work out what it meant until she saw the news. And my friend, though, came around and as they interrupted me, stopped me from taking the rest of the pills. She then drank the rest of the wine. and she sat and held my hand for 4 hours.
Oh, my God.
And her husband came around a bit later as well. And she then organized for some other friends of mine to kidnap me in a nice way. They kidnapped me and took me to the kind of the North Norfolk coast. And I was force fed lasagna for days, which is my comfort food. I was actually given a day of binging on burgers because that was better than eating charcoal to try and get stuff out of your system. So there's a good junk food is really good as a kind of a cleansing thing.
Good to know.
Oh, you want to eat charcoal, it doesn't taste nice. But again, so I'd taken enough not to have to be stomach pumped in hospital. But for like 3 to 4 days, I had a solid headache, paradoxically, despite the number of paracetamol I'd taken, and I couldn't take any more pills. And also my neighbour then went through the whole of my house and removed all of my pills from my house. And to this day, I don't keep pills in my house because I know that I can still feel suicidal. I don't want to have a suicide kit anymore, which is what I had. And I no longer, and even then I've been very practical with my suicide kit. I'd hidden it in 4 places around my house. So I knew that I couldn't do it spontaneously in the moment. A bit of the plus one was there. I knew that I would have to strategically seek out 4 sets of pills to combine them to have enough to do it. You know, and 4 months after all, it took me a week to forgive my neighbour and my friend for saving me. Because for a week, I didn't want to live. And then 3 months later, and in fact, 3 weeks before that, someone had made a bloody documentary about me. And it should have been one of the most amazing times of my life. And instead, 3 weeks later, I'm killing myself. So at the end of the documentary, after they heard it, they put a thing on the scrolling credits at the end. 3 weeks after the making of this film, Katie tried to take her life. But I survived, sort of thing. And the final credits on the film is me and the person who looked after me and at the coast walking across a beach talking about depression. And then 4 months after that, I ended up doing a stand-up comedy set all about suicide, taking a piss out of my own suicide as part of my own cathartic way of dealing with it. So that's why I do laugh about it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the power away from it. The things you laugh at no longer hold their power.
Oh, wow. That, thank you so much for sharing that story. There's so much to learn from that. There's so much to take away from that. And especially laughing takes the power away from it. And knowing how incredible it is to have people in your life that have your back like that and sit with you. And they're like, nope, I'm not going. We're in this together. And that's why I created this podcast, because we're not supposed to walk through life alone. We need each other. We need connection. We need conversation. We need community and to support each other.
And we don't do it enough anymore. The very people and places that we used to go and do that to, you know, the pub landlord, the village priest before they used to start molesting people, you know, and your mother, the, you know, the old woman in the town, whoever, there are so different communities and different cultures all have their different people. In Native American culture, some of the Two-Spirit people would have been the people that the tribe would have gone to, you know, for the agony aunts, whomever. Now we're so much separated from our families are disparate now. They're no longer around the corner. You can't just walk, you know, a couple of doors down the houses in your village and talk to your mum or your grandma. And that's integrating things like social media, integrating podcasts, integrating the fact that I treat my Facebook as an open diary half the time. And however I'm feeling, I'll sometimes just write it. What I tend to do now, in fact, in my diaries, I tend to put it on Facebook first and then copy it out of Facebook and put it back into my diary afterwards.
Oh my God.
Which is a form of total gross vulnerability. And it's a case of, you know, whether people like it or not, I'm going to say how I feel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Toned and well written and that kind of thing. And there's always, and however much we think we're being completely honest and vulnerable, we're not. We're controlling everything that we think and say. I love the idea that whenever you're even writing something about how you're feeling, you're actually observing your writing of how you're feeling. So yeah. Therefore, if you're doing that, it means you're kind of ghostwriting your own feelings. And there's another part of you who's observing the one writing it. And then there's something observing the one who's observing the one writing it. So you can never get to the bottom of it at the end of the day. But to have as many ways of being transparent and to peel your own onion skin in public or on Facebook or in a diary or however, or through writing music or through jumping on a podcast or not worrying about what people think about you, it is so healthy. And it's also the way future diaries are going to be discovered is through things like podcasts and Facebook statuses, because very few people are writing them down traditionally now.
It's so true. And it's like, well, also my diary, when I try and go back and read that shit, it is so messy and not legible that I'm like, I love that there's podcasts and Facebook statuses and blog posts and all these things that I can actually go back and like read what I was actually thinking. Cause I will try and read my writing and be like, really have no idea what those words are.
Well, one of your episodes that you did, it was just you interviewing yourself, which is brilliant. and about your dating experiences and everything else. I fucking loved it because it was just so real, you know. Yeah. And it's, why not go out there and just talk to the world as if it's your mum?
Oh my God, right? I tell my mom everything whenever I'm on the phone with my mom. I remember this with the people I lived with when I was in Vancouver. I would like be on the phone with my mom and be like talking about like things that like stereotypically you talk to your mom about. And then the next, you know, I'd be like, oh my God, I was really high the other day. And I was like talking to this guy and like murmur. And people will be like, I'll get off the phone and they'll be like, who were you talking to? I was like, I was talking to my mom. And they're like, and you told her about how you like smoked weed or like went on a date with a guy and kissed a guy. I'm like, yeah, it's my mom.
Yeah,
I tell her everything.
I've told my mum pretty much, well, I told my mum everything from about the age of 5 and she told me everything pretty much as well, which is a kid to cope with. But, and then I went into this zone of 15, I used to diary in my teenage years and I diaried every day since I came out. But in the whole of my 15 years of my marriage, I didn't diary once.
And that's when you know like, something is not right.
Yes. Well, no, I didn't know. It took me 15 years to know.
Well, when you look back.
Yeah. In hindsight, it was very obvious that I put my life on pause to make someone else happy and to follow what was then, because I was then religious as well, what was considered to be then the right path of marriage, Christianity, career, doing normal stuff, I thought was the way. I thought it was a way to bury who I was and actually to bury the version of me that I was worried about, who actually turned out to be the real me. But wow. Also it was standard, is what you do. It's a lot, and that's why Esther and I often talk about this phrase called the relationship escalator. It's the idea that if you do one thing, the next thing has to follow, like moving in, or the kissing goes to touching and touching goes to sex and sex goes to relationship and relationship goes to moving in and moving in goes to having kids. And then you're with each other for life. Well, you know, why do you have to escalate? There are some people who just want to kiss. There are some people you just want to hold hands with. There are some people you just want to have sex with and never kiss. You know, there are whole, you can jump in at any stage of that and do things in any order. And nothing should have this obvious, massive logical escalator that has to follow it.
Wow.
Why not enjoy the moment of anything? I'm transparently me, authentically me. And if you don't like my energy, you can leave.
Yeah, that's the thing too, is that like I learned, I'm like, we're not supposed to like everybody. Imagine if you, we're not like even in terms of therapy, finding therapists, not every therapist is going to work for you. Therefore, not every person you meet is going to be friends with you. So
no, like, you have to test your therapist. That's fun. That's a fun stage. But you know, to find the one that's right for you, I fall in love with all my therapists, a standard transference. Everyone knows that. But they've all become my friends now, which is fabulous. And I love that. But I also, after breaking up from a psychiatrist and then trying to find myself. The weird thing is, for the next 6 years, I ended up dating therapists as well as being in therapy.
And so interesting.
I know. I have a thing for therapists. Now, I have a thing for people who have a thing for the mind and a thing for your deepest inner being that you want to bring to the surface and be yourself. So anyone who supports that, I love.
That is so me. I am so like, I could not, like, I'm never happier than like when I sit and do podcast episodes and talk about things like this, or just like have conversations that are so meaningful. And it's just my favorite thing. And I'm like, was just looking at my school schedule, cause I'm studying psychology and want to do my master's in social work and become a therapist. And I was looking at my classes right before we got on this call, and I'm doing a class all about sleep. And I was like, I'm so excited to just like sit and like learn about all of this, to be able to sit too and like hear about your mental health journey and your experience with suicide and how you had a suicide kit. It's just so eye-opening for me.
And I'm fascinated by psychology as well. I've got 6,000 books at home, and about 300 of them are psychology books and things. Cause I tried to physician heal thyself. So I went to psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists to try and heal myself. Or I tried to go to self-help books and psychology books and medical textbooks and everything to try and solve myself, the riddle that is me. I didn't need to read any of them in the end, but the knowledge stays in my head of them. And for as many studies that are out there, as many kind of combinations of data that say X percent of people feel this way or do that, it takes you away in the end. Whilst those things indicate, you know, prevalence and causes and all these things, the thing that it really gets you to the heart of the psychology of another person is a podcast now. It's an interview with another human being.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, that's why I do things like the Human Library, because you know, you can understand everything. You can read every document and every study and every book about being transgender or being bipolar, but having a 30-minute conversation with another trans person or bipolar person who opens up about their unique experience and life and feelings cannot be captured in a study, cannot be captured in a book, because real empathy comes from listening to a human being talk about and that's why there's no right or wrong way to talk about suicide. If I want to say I committed suicide, people say, no, that's the wrong place. You can't use the word committed, because that sounds like it's criminally wrong. You know, you use take your own life. And I hate the fact that people, even within communities or well-meaning people, will judge the language that we use. If I say I'm crazy, that's up to me. Yeah. You know, it's not stigmatizing the word crazy. The language we use of ourselves has to be owned by ourselves, and the way we open up and someone empathizes with us has to be based on genuine connection, not saying that's the correct way to talk about bipolar, that's the correct way to talk about being trans. And so I found that's why I love psychology still, but only if the end result of every paper, every study, every lecture is discovering the humanity of the person in front of you. Instead, what you end up doing is you tend to put them into a category, you tend to put them into a class, you pathologize them. You say, oh, they must be this because X happened to them. If you're profiling them, in other words, in some way.
Yeah, we can't put each other in boxes. We can't put ourselves in boxes, because that's exactly when you get to stop being completely you, because we're all so different, have so much depth to us that it can never be categorized.
Which is why I love the unique 3D layers of who people are. And that's why everybody you meet has got something to teach you. Even if they don't know it or don't think it, because they're the only person who's experienced their life and there's stuff in their life that you haven't ever experienced or known about. So everybody is interesting. Everybody has something to teach you or tell you. I mean, I would literally say to anyone, there is nothing that you can't ask me. Mm-hmm. But I also
and that's powerful.
But I also have enough safety that if there comes a case where I feel it's not appropriate to answer it for that particular person in that particular moment, I know how to not make them wrong for asking it. I know how to deflect or to say, thank you for your question. You know, unfortunately, I'm not in the right space right now to be able to share that with you. I don't make it about them. I always want to appreciate their curiosity. But I've had people ask me stuff from a position of criticism or even potentially hate and turn it around within the answer completely. Because how you respond says more about you know, what you say and all the rest of it, and how you treat someone's question. And it completely disarms someone if you don't take it personally. And, you know, of all those different kind of self-help programs, one of the things I remember is the Four Spiritual Laws one. One of the laws in that was about don't take anything personally, because the way people react says more about them than it says about you.
100%. It's so true. And I think that's, and with so many conversations, when people judge you, it says so much more about who they are than who you are. Yeah.
God, absolutely.
Okay. Where can people also follow you and find you online so they can, you know, learn more about Katie?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I kept my unique name, which is Katie, K-A-T-Y, and John, J-O-N, my two birth names, actually, which is a whole part of the story we didn't even go down rabbit hole-wise.
Oh, my gosh. Next time, for sure. Next yeah. episode.
As a result of that, it means I'm infinitely Googleable. All you've got to do is type in Katie John. There's only one of me. And my website is katiejohn.com. My Twitter and Instagram handles are either Katie John or Katie John Went. There's plenty of media out there, interviews and TED Talks and other stuff, and a documentary. Actually, katiejohn.com/film has got a whole bunch of clips of interviews and other things like that as well. There's plenty Amazing. Of podcasts out there other than yours, which has been the best to date.
Oh my God, did you guys hear that? That means so much. I definitely want people to check out 50 Shades of Gender too. Your episode is incredible on there. Love Esther. Love the podcast. Love you. So good. I'm so glad you enjoyed coming on the podcast. It was amazing. I think this is my favorite episode to date too, Aww. To be honest.
Until the next one.
They all are so different. They bring such different things, but you have just such a calm, happy, welcoming energy. It is the best thing ever.
Thank you, Jess. And that goes to you too, because you really are. I mean, again, finding a therapist, finding a podcast host with whom you're comfortable opening up to is the same thing as a decent therapist.
Oh, I love that so much.